The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. Hard Times. By the mid-19th century, England was in the grip of the Industrial Revolution and was the world's leading manufacturer. Factories sprang up all over the Midlands and the northern counties, and the mass production of goods meant long hours of intense labour on low wages for the workforce. The consequent reduction in the quality of life for these workers led to illness, disease, and desperation. Sensitive as always to the mood of his times, Dickens chose as the theme for his 1854 novel, Hard Times, industry and its effects. Dickens saw with alarm that individual worth and self-esteem were beginning to be measured purely in monetary terms, and he wanted to sound a warning. Dickens's description of the fictitious Coke Town, where the novel is set, has all the atmosphere of a grainy black-and-white photograph from the era. Indeed, smoky black is the dismal colour in the description. It was a town of red brick, if smoke and ashes had allowed it. The workers blend into this industrial landscape, and even the central working-class character Stephen Blackpool is not marked out by any individual characteristics. He serves Dickens's theme, and is portrayed as a victim of a ruthless system on a downward spiral into an utter muddle, as Blackpool calls it. But Dickens's examination of industrial conditions becomes a secondary theme when he decides to attack the new belief of utilitarianism. Utilitarianism, or more simply, usefulness, was a theory developed by the philosopher John Stuart Mill, which advocated that taste should be dictated by rules and acknowledged principles, rather than innate or instinctive feeling. In short, taste has no value if it is not useful. This was the starting point for the conflict in Hard Times, facts versus imagination, or fancy, as Dickens termed it. For Dickens, the dull, cruel world would have been unbearable without imagination, which was the very source of his creative writing. The inhabitants of Coketown are at the mercy of utilitarian educators, bent on teaching them the facts of life, with no allowance for indulging their fancies. Dickens turns away from creating a social document to construct Hard Times as an imaginative fable. Its simplicity of style resembles his other fables, the Christmas books. The two guardians of utilitarianism in Coketown are Mr. Bounderby and Mr. Gradgrind. Bounderby is a monster of comic cruelty and savagery, a self-made man who despises anyone who has not suffered as he did. He is a prig and a bully, whose self-delusion is the source of much humour. He represents the new Victorian values of power achieved by wealth and industry, rather than by blood or class. He is callous in his response to Blackpool's troubles. He had risen from nothing and made something of himself, so why couldn't Blackpool? But Bounderby, the enemy of fancy, is ironically the book's greatest exponent of it, for his whole life turns out to be a sham, presented as truth. Gradgrind travels the farthest journey in the story, finally realizing that it is his false beliefs that have ruined his son and daughter, and that he must recreate himself as a loving, caring father. His children, Louisa and Tom, bombarded all their lives with nothing but facts, are dysfunctional and disconnected. News of a strike by workers in Preston early in 1854 offered Dickens a basis of reality for his novel. Dickens was no socialist and mistrusted the early trade union movement known as combinations. In his eyes, like the utilitarian educators, they stopped the workers thinking for themselves. There is no hint of early socialism in Slackbridge, the union leader. He is a bully, out to intimidate the workforce, working for self-interest and not the general good, just like the capitalist Bounderby. So if Dickens did not see trades unions as the answer to social problems in an industrial town, where did it lie? He sees the answer in the circus. A tinsel world, perhaps, but one that valued imagination. And for Dickens, imagination led to sympathy. The circus folk instinctively share and share alike as they face the hardship of life on the road. Sleary's horse riding, a troop of itinerant show people led by the irrepressibly optimistic Mr. Sleary, becomes the repository of warm human nature. The alternative to cold, dehumanized, soulless work. Sleary is a richly comic creation, complete with an almost unintelligible lisp, who shows tender feelings, warmth, generosity, and wisdom. The grim humour and harsh tone of Dickens's writing in Hard Times have led some critics to consider it to be more of a political tract than a novel. However, Dickens's politics were for the most part dictated by his sentimentality and sense of romance rather than sound principles. He ultimately shows a humane solution to the situation in Hard Times rather than a political one. Nevertheless, Karl Marx said of Dickens that he had issued to the world more political and social truths than have been uttered by all the professional politicians, publicists, and moralists put together. Coketown School.
Now what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children, and this is the principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts, sir. The scene was a plain, bare, monotonous vault of a schoolroom, and the speaker's square forefinger emphasised his observations by underscoring every sentence with a line on the schoolmaster's sleeve. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's square wall of a forehead, which had his eyebrows for its base, while his eyes found commodious cellarage in two dark caves overshadowed by the wall. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's mouth, which was wide, thin, and hard-set. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's voice, which was inflexible, dry, and dictatorial. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's hair, which bristled on the skirts of his bald head, a plantation of furs to keep the wind from its shining surface, all covered with knobs like the crust of a plum pie, as if the head had scarcely warehouse room for the hard facts stored inside. The speaker's obstinate carriage, square coat, square legs, square shoulders, nay, his very neckcloth, trained to take him by the throat with an unaccommodating grasp, like a stubborn fact as it was, all helped the emphasis. In this life, we want nothing but facts, sir. Nothing but facts. The speaker and the schoolmaster and the third grown person present all backed a little and swept with their eyes the inclined plane of little vessels then and there arranged in order, ready to have imperial gallons of facts poured into them until they were full to the brim. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, a man of realities, a man of facts and calculations, a man who proceeds upon the principle that two and two are four and nothing over, and who is not to be talked into allowing for anything over. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, peremptorily Thomas, Thomas Gradgrind. With a rule and a pair of scales, and the multiplication table always in his pocket, sir, ready to weigh and measure any parcel of human nature, and tell you exactly what it comes to. It is a mere question of figures, a case of simple arithmetic. You might hope to get some other nonsensical belief into the head of George Gradgrind, or Augustus Gradgrind, or John Gradgrind, or Joseph Gradgrind, all superstitious, non-existent persons, but into the head of Thomas Gradgrind. No, sir. In such terms, Mr. Gradgrind always mentally introduced himself, whether to his private circle of acquaintance or to the public in general. In such terms, no doubt, substituting the words boys and girls for sir, Thomas Gradgrind now presented Thomas Gradgrind to the little pitchers before him, who were to be filled so full of facts. Indeed, as he eagerly sparkled at them from the cellarage before mentioned, he seemed a kind of cannon, loaded to the muzzle with facts, and prepared to blow them clean out of the regions of childhood at one discharge. He seemed a galvanizing apparatus, too, charged with a grim mechanical substitute for the tender young imaginations that were to be stormed away.
"Girl number 20," said Mr. Gradgrind, squarely pointing with his square forefinger. I don't know that girl. Who is that girl?
Cissy Jupp, sir,
explained number 20, blushing, standing up, and curtsying.
Cissy is not a name, said Mr. Gradgrind. Don't call yourself Cissy. Call yourself Cecilia.
It's father as calls me Cissy, sir,
returned the young girl in a trembling voice and with another curtsy.
Then he has no business to do it, said Mr. Gradgrind. Tell him he mustn't.
Mr. Bounderby.
In the formal drawing-room of Stone Lodge, standing on the hearthrug, warming himself before the fire, Mr. Bounderby delivered some observations to Mrs. Gradgrind on the circumstance of its being his birthday. He stood before the fire, partly because it was a cool spring afternoon, though the sun shone, partly because the shade of Stone Lodge was always haunted by the ghost of damp mortar, partly because he thus took up a commanding position from which to subdue Mrs. Gradgrind.
"I hadn't a shoe to my foot. As to a stocking, I didn't know such a thing by name. I passed the day in a ditch and the night in a pigsty. That's the way I spent my 10th birthday. Not that a ditch was new to me, for I was born in a ditch."
Mrs. Gradgrind, a little thin, white, pink-eyed bundle of shawls, of surpassing feebleness, mental and bodily, who was always taking physic without any effect, and who, whenever she showed a symptom of coming to life, was invariably stunned by some weighty piece of fact tumbling on her. Mrs. Gradgrind hoped it was a dry ditch.
"No, as wet as a sop, a foot of water in it," said Mr. Bounderby.
"Enough to give a baby cold,"
Mrs. Gradgrind considered.
"Cold? I was born with inflammation of the lungs and of everything else, I believe, that was capable of inflammation," returned Mr. Bounderby. "For years, ma'am, I was one of the most miserable little wretches ever seen. I was so sickly that I was always moaning and groaning. I was so ragged and dirty that you wouldn't have touched me with a pair of tongs."
Mrs. Gradgrind faintly looked at the tongs as the most appropriate thing her imbecility could think of doing.
"How I fought through it, I don't know," said Bounderby. "I was determined, I suppose. I've been a determined character in later life, and I suppose I was then. Here I am, Mrs. Gradgrind, anyhow, and nobody to thank for my being here but myself."
Mrs. Gradgrind meekly and weakly hoped that his mother...
"My mother? Bolted, ma'am," said Bounderby.
Mrs. Gradgrind, stunned as usual, collapsed and gave it up.
"My mother left me to my grandmother," said Bounderby. "And according to the best of my remembrance, my grandmother was the wickedest and the worst old woman that ever lived. If I got a little pair of shoes, by any chance, she'd take them off and sell them for drink. I have known that grandmother of mine lie in her bed and drink her 14 glasses of liquor before breakfast."
Mrs. Gradgrind, weakly smiling and giving no other sign of vitality, looked, as she always did, like an indifferently executed transparency of a small female figure, without enough light behind it.
"She kept a chandler's shop," pursued Bounderby, "and kept me in an egg box. That was the cot of my infancy, an old egg box. As soon as I was big enough to run away, of course I ran away. Then I became a young vagabond, and instead of one old woman knocking me about and starving me, everybody of all ages knocked me about and starved me. They were right. They had no business to do anything else. I was a nuisance, an encumbrance, and a pest. I know that very well."
His pride in having at any time of his life achieved such a great social distinction as to be a nuisance, an encumbrance, and a pest was only to be satisfied by three sonorous repetitions of the boast.
"I was to pull through it, I suppose, Mrs. Gradgrind. Whether I was to do it or not, ma'am, I did it. I pulled through it, though nobody threw me out a rope. Vagabond, errand boy, vagabond, labourer, porter, clerk, chief manager, small partner, Josiah Bounderby of Coketown. Those are the antecedents and the culmination. Josiah Bounderby of Coketown learnt his letters from the outsides of the shops, Mrs. Gradgrind, and was first able to tell the time upon a dial plate from studying the steeple clock of St. Giles's Church, London, under the direction of a drunken cripple, who was a convicted thief and an incorrigible vagrant. Tell Josiah Bounderby a Coketown of your district schools and your model schools and your training schools and your old kettle of fish of schools, and Josiah Bounderby a Coketown tells you plainly, all right, all correct, he hadn't such advantages, but let us have hard-headed, solid-fisted people. The education that made him won't do for everybody, he knows well. Such and such his education was, however, and you may force him to swallow boiling fat, but you shall never force him to suppress the facts of his life.
Sleary's Circus.
Meanwhile, the various members of Sleary's company gradually gathered together from the upper regions where they were quartered, and from standing about, talking in low voices to one another and to Mr. Childers, gradually insinuated themselves and him into the room. There were two or three handsome young women among them, with their two or three husbands and their two or three mothers, and their eight or nine little children, who did the fairy business when required. The father of one of the families was in the habit of balancing the father of another of the families on the top of a great pole. The father of a third family often made a pyramid of both those fathers, with Master Kidderminster for the apex, and himself for the base. All the fathers could dance upon rolling casks, stand upon bottles, catch knives and balls, twirl hand basins, ride upon anything, jump over everything, and stick at nothing. All the mothers could and did dance upon the slack wire and the tightrope and perform rapid acts on bare-backed steeds. None of them were at all particular in respect of showing their legs, and one of them, alone in a Greek chariot, drove six in hand into every town they came to. They all assumed to be mighty rakish and knowing. They were not very tidy in their private dresses. They were not at all orderly in their domestic arrangements, and the combined literature of the whole company would have produced but a poor letter on any subject. Yet there was a remarkable gentleness and childishness about these people, a special inaptitude for any kind of sharp practice, and an untiring readiness to help and pity one another, deserving often of as much respect and always of as much generous construction as the everyday virtues of any class of people in the world. Last of all appeared Mr. Sleary, a stout man, as already mentioned, with one fixed eye and one loose eye, a voice, if it can be called so, like the efforts of a broken old pair of bellows, a flabby surface and a muddled head which was never sober and never drunk.
"Squire,"
said Mr. Sleary, who was troubled with asthma, and whose breath came far too thick and heavy for the letter S.,
"your servant. This is a bad piece of business, this is. You've heard of my clown and his dog being supposed to have morrised?"
He addressed Mr. Gradgrind, who answered yes.
"Well, squire,"
he returned, taking off his hat and rubbing the lining with his pocket handkerchief, which he kept inside for the purpose,
"is it your intention to do anything for the poor girl, squire?"
"I shall have something to propose to her when she comes back," said Mr. Gradgrind.
"Glad to hear it, squire. Not that I want to get rid of the child any more than I want to stand in her way. I'm willing to take her apprentice, though at her age it's late. My voice is a little husky, squire, and not easy heard by them as don't know me. But if you've been chilled and heated, heated and chilled and heated in the ring when you was young as often as I've been, your voice wouldn't have lasted out, squire, no more than mine."
"I dare say not," said Mr. Gradgrind.
What shall it be, squire, while you wait? Shall it be Sherry? Give it a name, squire,"
said Mr. Sleary, with hospitable ease.
"Nothing for me, I thank you," said Mr. Gradgrind.
"Don't say nothing, squire. What does your friend say? If you haven't took your feed yet, have a glass of bitters."
Here his daughter Josephine, a pretty fair-haired girl of 18 who had been tied on a horse at 2 years old, and had made a will at 12, which she always carried about with her, expressive of her dying desire to be drawn to the grave by the two piebald ponies, cried,
"Father, hush, she's come back."
Then came Sissy Jupe, running into the room as she had run out of it, and when she saw them all assembled and saw their looks and saw no father there, she broke into a most deplorable cry and took refuge on the bosom of the most accomplished tightrope lady, herself in the family way, who knelt down on the floor to nurse her and to weep over her.
"It's an internal shame upon my soul, it is,"
said Sleary.
Oh, my dear father, my good, kind father, where are you gone? You're gone to try to do me some good, I know. You're gone away for my sake, I'm sure. And how miserable and helpless you'll be without me, poor, poor father, until you come back.
It was so pathetic to hear her saying many things of this kind, with her face turned upward and her arms stretched out as if she were trying to stop his departing shadow and embrace it, that no one spoke a word, until Mr. Bounderby, growing impatient, took the case in hand.
"Now, good people all," said he, "this is wanton waste of time. Let the girl understand the fact. Let her take it from me, if you like. I've been run away from myself. Here, what's your name? Your father has absconded, deserted you, and you mustn't expect to see him again as long as you live."
They cared so little for plain fact, these people, and were in that advanced state of degeneracy on the subject that instead of being impressed by the speaker's strong common sense, they took it in extraordinary dudgeon. The men muttered, "Shame," and the women, "Brute," and Sleary, in some haste, communicated the following hint apart to Mr. Bounderby.
"I'll tell you what, Squire, to speak plain to you, my opinion is that you had better cut it short and drop it. They're a very good-natured people, my people, but they're accustomed to be quick in their movements, and if you don't act upon my advice, I'm damned if I don't believe they'll piss you out the window."
Stephen Blackpool in the Mineshaft.
"Sir, I canna with my little learning and my common way tell the gentleman what will better o'er this, though some working men of this town could above my powers. But I can tell him what I know will never do't. The strong hand will never do't. Victory and triumph will never do't. Agreeing for to mak one side unnaturally allers and forever right, and t'other side unnaturally allers and forever wrong will never do't. Nor yet letting alone will never do't. Let thousands upon thousands alone, all leading the like lives, and all falling into the like muddle, and there will be as one, and yo' will be as another, wi' a black, unpassable world betwixt you, just as long or short a time as such like misery can last. Not drawing nigh to folk, wi' kindness and patience and cheery ways, that so draws nigh to one another in their mony troubles, and so cherishes one another in their distresses with what they need themselves. Like a humbly believer's no people the gentleman has seen in all his travels can beat, will never do till the sun turns to ice. Most of all, rating them as so much power and regulating them, as if there was figures in a sum or machines, without loves and likings, without memories and inclinations, without souls to weary and souls to hope. When all goes quiet, dragging on with 'em as if they'd nowt of the kind, and when all goes unquiet, reproaching 'em for their want of sich humanly feelings in their dealings with yo. This will never do't, sir, till God's work is unmade." Stephen stood with the open door in his hand, waiting to know if anything more were expected of him.
"Just stop a moment," said Mr. Bounderby, excessively red in the face. "I told you the last time you were here with a grievance that you'd better turn about and come out of that, and I also told you, if you remember, that I was up to the gold spoon, look out."
"I were not up to it myself, sir, I do assure you."
"Now it's clear to me," said Mr. Bounderby, "that you are one of those chaps who have always got a grievance, and you go about sowing it and raising crops. That's the business of your life, my friend."
Stephen shook his head, mutely protesting that indeed he had other business to do for his life.
"You are such a waspish, raspish, ill-conditioned chap, you see," said Mr. Bounderby, "that even your own union, the men who know you best, will have nothing to do with you. I never thought those fellows could be right in anything, but I tell you what, I so far go along with them for a novelty that I'll have nothing to do with you either."
Stephen raised his eyes quickly to his face.
"You can finish off what you're at," said Mr. Bounderby with a meaning nod, "and then go elsewhere."
"Sir, you know well," said Stephen expressively, "that if I canna get what with you, I canna get it elsewhere."
The reply was,
"What I know, I know, and what you know, you know. I have no more to say about it."
Stephen glanced at Louisa again, but her eyes were raised to his no more. Therefore, with a sigh, and saying barely above his breath, "Heaven help us all in this world," he departed.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of Hard Times, read by Anton Lesser for Naxos Audiobooks.